Hello, everybody. I'm Jacopo Dettoni, and this is the FDI podcast. The United Kingdom voted to leave the European Union in June 2016. The outcome of the Brexit referendum defied all the polls, but the uncertainty it created came largely as expected. After over a year since the referendum, we still don't know what a full Brexit deal will look like. Brexit Secretary David Davis and his European counterpart Michel Barnier have time until March 2019 to define the terms of the UK's departure from the European Union. But the British cabinet remains divided and the European side has little incentive in speeding up negotiations. In fact, the slower the talks proceed, the more likely it becomes for British businesses to consider relocating into the European Union. This whole uncertainty has inevitably taken a toll on the British economy. Economic growth stalled, the sterling lost about 50% in currency markets, and now we are also in a position to gauge a first Brexit impact on foreign investment into the country. I'm here in London to discuss this all with Dr. Swati Dhingra, lecturer at the London School of Economics, and Courtney Finger, editor-in-chief of FDI magazine. Swati, Courtney, welcome to the show.
Thanks.
So what do we know so far? What has been the impact of Brexit in terms of foreign investment into the country in these first 12, 13 months?
Well, at FDI Intelligence, which is, of course, the data division that FDI Magazine belongs to, we've now finalized our figures as of the end of June 2017. So we're really only able at this point to see what has happened in the year since the vote to leave the European Union. And as expected, it's not really good news for UK greenfield inward investment. What we tracked is a decline in number of projects by 19%. That's comparing the year in the lead up to the June referendum and the year following, and more staggeringly, a decrease in capital investments. So the actual value of those projects has declined by 38%.
What were your feelings when you first saw these figures?
Well, I think it's not a surprise. So most people were predicting, most FDI experts anyway, were predicting a decline in inward investment. And it was inevitable that the volatility and the uncertainty that was unleashed by the vote to leave the European Union would hit FDI flows. I couldn't really see a way around that. The 38% decline in capital investment is surprising in how large that decline is. What we don't know, of course, is how long that will last. Capital investment flows are difficult to track and measure because they rely a lot on estimates, and we never really know when money's being phased in and out. So they're very hard to get a handle on, but I think it's still indicative that investors are at least perhaps scared of large-scale projects. I think project numbers is often the best indicator because these are easier to track, easier to measure. And so I think even a 19% decline in project numbers is in some ways more worrying than the 38% decline in capital investment.
Was this decline sort of evenly spread, or there was any particular sector that suffered more than others?
It's fairly evenly spread. I broke it all down when we looked on our spreadsheet looking at the UK's key FDI sectors, and I was highlighting and putting in red the sectors showing a decline and green the sectors showing an increase, and there was red all over the page. So we saw declines in nearly every major FDI sector that the UK has. So I think it's because, of course, the uncertainty impacts every sector. Different sectors have different concerns. You know, for some, it's very much about access to market, trade, tariffs, and so on. All sectors care about access to talent, but the sectors that are more high value and that require a highly skilled talent, of course, are concerned about being able to bring in workers that they need and movement of people. So I think different sectors have different concerns, but all of them are showing some level of concern.
Okay, well, Swati, you guys at the Center of Economic Performance at the LSE produced a solid volume of research into the possible effects of on the economy from Brexit. So are these first results on FDI sort of in line with your original expectations?
I think they're completely consistent with what we were expecting, except what we didn't realize was that the effect would happen this quickly and that it would be on the higher end of what our estimates are. So I think this is what I'm learning from what Courtney is just saying, that this is really at the higher end of what our range was. We were thinking about a 20% decline in FDI, which would happen after exiting the European Union. This is happening much faster now, and the magnitudes on the upper end.
Right. So do you think when we talk about this whole uncertainty, what do you think are the main factors that are sort of deterring or will deter investors from sort of taking a long-term bet into the British economy?
So the first component, of course, is going to be what's happening to our relationship with the European Union. Are we going to be members of the single market, of the customs union? Because all of those factors will determine how costs of doing business with the European Union will go up. And not only that, what it will also do is that if an American multinational wants to come and invest in the UK, they're going to think twice, because earlier what was available to them through the UK market was essentially the entire European Union market. And that potentially won't be the case. And that's really where the uncertainty is coming from.
Right, right. So let's try to add some more perspective. So is the UK losing FDI to other European countries? Or we can say this is a more regional trend?
Well, I would say that the UK is losing some investment, in particular to European countries. There might be some companies that are just holding off on making any plans until they see what happens. But as we've seen, for example, in the financial services sector, companies and banks and financial institutions are already having to hedge and make expansions in Europe, on the continent, or in Dublin, for example. So I think what we're seeing is a lot of companies hedging. So almost certainly the UK is losing some projects to places within continental Europe and within the European Union.
In the industrial sector, you think that the selling proposition of other European countries that have been lobbying over the last 12 months to attract investment out of the UK and into Europe, are they being successful? Have they got like good arguments to convince investors to move facilities, workforce, or investment out of the country?
So what I've heard from a lot of my European colleagues seems to be that they're all advising their governments about how to attract businesses from the UK to their own country. So that's definitely happening. How effective that would be, we don't know. It's too early to tell. And I think one of the big concerns here is that even sort of traditional sectors, which at the moment are showing positives, like the automotive industry, we don't know how that's going to unfold. And many of the solutions being proposed really are not sort of going to address all of the increased costs that will happen after a Brexit deal. And this is why when we've done estimates of what would happen, say, in the car industry after leaving the European Union, if tariffs do come into place, which is what would happen if we exit the customs union, we don't do a free trade area, then we're talking about something like a 12% reduction in the amount of cars that are produced in the UK to be able to sell to the rest of the world.
That's right. One of the interesting things I noticed when I crunched our figures recently was that we tracked that number of manufacturing projects has increased in the UK since the referendum. And I suspect that is purely for the short term, because companies that are looking to serve just the UK market, because it's a decent sized consumer market in its own right, they actually would be incentivized to now produce in the UK rather than serve this market from in the EU. But of course, those that were geared for export are the ones for whom these tariffs are going to be pretty detrimental.
Exactly. I'm completely in agreement here. In fact, the car industry, the numbers that I was telling you, there was an increase in our estimates on what was produced for domestic consumers. Mm-hmm. But because so much of our car exports go to the European Union and the rest of the world, that number is just not enough. That pickup in domestic production is not enough to essentially make up for the loss in export consumption that's going to happen.
Exactly. And especially if the economy takes a hit from all this uncertainty, then there will be less buying power, less consumer demand, and then we're in a bit of a fix in that respect.
Sure. Can I add one more thing to that? So I think it needs to be kept in mind that we always think of FDI as being big multinational corporations. But the moment you sort of see economic contraction happening, that means that all the other people who are related to this, to the UK economy, that could be somebody who's not in a big firm, somebody who's in a small company, that uncertainty actually is much more damaging to small firms than to big businesses. So everybody would potentially suffer.
It's much harder for SMEs to absorb these kinds of shocks.
Yeah. Exactly.
It's interesting that you mentioned the automotive sector. There is where we had a couple of the government had a couple of good news, good commitments from Nissan and BMW that sort of reiterated their commitment to future investments into the country. But they are also when they did so, they made very clear that the success of their future ventures will eventually hinge on a development of deeper structures. stronger local supply chains, most of all in the perspective of reinstating barrier tariff or any sort of direct or indirect trade barrier between the European Union and the United Kingdom. So, Swati, how big of a room for the country or for the government there is out there to better develop local supply chains in the industrial sector, in sectors like in key sectors, key employers like automotive sector?
So getting local content within the automotive industry to go higher is actually something which the UK government has been thinking of for many years. This is not something new. That we're about almost at roughly, I think about 40% is the local content currently in the cars produced by the UK. Most trade agreements that the UK has with the rest of the world and with the European Union want something like 50% local content requirements. But getting that number to go up is not something which happens just through sort of very simple industrial policy. This takes years and years to build. So it's not as though tomorrow immediately we will go to 50% local content. That is a much long drawn out process, which is connected to various things from education, health, to what you do in terms of tax incentives and tariffs.
So, and it's interesting where, for example, BMW want to produce electronic mini models in the UK. They also said that the batteries, the electronic batteries and the electronic engines will come from Germany. So again, there is definitely a lot to explore there for the government, also in the perspective of setting the details of a future possible trade agreement between the UK and the European Union. Within this perspective, so if you look forward, if you look beyond the Brexit deal, so the government and the European Union have got until March 2019 to define the details of the divorce, and then probably there will be a transition period leading ideally to a trade agreement, a new trade agreement between the UK and the European Union. But in the meantime, conservative MPs are already kind of exploring options to make to deliver on their promise, the Brexiteers' promise of regaining control of their foreign trade policy. One of the options, one of the proposals on the table is also the development of free trade zones within the United Kingdom. This hasn't really happened as of today, because the European Union has always tried to put brakes on the development of free zones within the European Union, because they are considered a sort of state aid. And so they are sort of allied, especially economic zones are allowed just when they fit a development agenda in more deprived zones like Eastern Europe or new European Union member countries. But now there is a proposal on the table, and there is a Tory MP called Rishi Sunak, MP for Richmond, that is championing this idea. And I spoke to him a couple of weeks ago, and this is what he told me.
Everywhere they've been used around the world, the evidence is that they boost manufacturing output, they boost trade, and as it happens in the UK, all our ports are in areas that we would like to see more economic regeneration. So I think the combination of all those benefits means that free ports can be an exciting and very positive development for Britain. If you look at the UK's 30 largest ports, say, you know, over half of them are in the bottom quartile of, you know, social deprivation. Three quarters of all of those ports are below average in terms of their deprivation. So, you know, that to me is an exciting prospect, but this would be an idea that would target economic growth in areas where we would really like to see more economic growth. And there's a lot of talk about rebalancing growth away from London and the southeast to the rest of the economy, especially in the north where my constituency is. This policy would deliver that outcome.
Before asking your feedback, your comment on this, I also tried to get the sentiment amongst the port operators. So I spoke to Associated British Ports, which is the largest UK port operator, and specifically to David Layton, head of corporate affairs. And this is what he told me about this proposal.
In the context of departure from the customs union and or single market, we need to look at the opportunities that are capable of maintaining economic growth, and that includes facilitating imports and exports and making that can happen as smoothly as possible. But in the broader sense, what UK government needs to do in particular is to also look towards, which I think is what this report points to, you know, innovative and creative policy ideas which can help advance the UK's wider competitiveness. And I think in doing that, that is inevitably going to be attractive to our customers, but also future potential customers and potential investors who might be looking towards investing in the UK in the future.
There are two main things here. Freeports could, according to this proposal, they could help boost the competitiveness of the country in a post-Brexit scenario where the UK is sort of out of the customs union and the single market, but they could also be like an important driver for the development of the private zone around these port areas. What do you make of all this?
So I think free ports are good in the sense that at the moment we have about 5,000 customs officials. You compare to some country like Germany, which has about 35,000 customs officials. So we're not prepared to deal with any kinds of massive sort of tariffs coming into place. So in that sense, it's a good idea to be able to give us some kind of transition. But I don't see it as a replacement to either trying to get tariff-free access and, most importantly, non-tariff barrier-free access to the European Union market. Free trade ports don't really address that issue because they're completely unilateral policies. We need to get agreement from the European Union to get trade costs down after Brexit happens. And more importantly, they also don't replace industrial strategy in general. So trying to come up with, you know, policies like the Northern Powerhouse is not something which is necessarily something we should throw out to be able to have free ports in. I mean, this is a conversation we can have as a nation, but broadly speaking, free ports is not some kind of quick fix to both the trade problems and the industrial strategy problems that are there in this country.
Yes, I agree. It's not a solution really to the bigger problems that Brexit is posing. I think it is a situation where they could bring some benefit. I think the regeneration that we heard about does make sense. If the UK is going to be out of the EU, it might as well maximize the opportunity to make its own tax legislation and so on, because of course that's also what we were sold on, in the sense of that was meant to be one of the benefits of Brexit. So I feel like if that's the road that the UK is going down, might as well maximize opportunities where possible. But I do agree as well that that's really no replacement for a comprehensive, good trade agreement with the EU and other countries as well.
And there's also this issue of the free trade zones don't always work. I mean, the evidence is very mixed, and it's really a matter of how quickly you're able to react to when things start going wrong. Now, do we have that sort of ability or not in the country is really what's going to be crucial.
Right, right. And it's interesting also, like in the 80s, during the government of Margaret Thatcher, they tried already to launch a pilot phase for free ports, six free ports in a country. And that didn't really work out for a couple of reasons. Well, first of all, there was already opposition from the European Union, but also there was internal opposition from within the customs authority, British customs authority, that basically they were saying that this was not necessary and it was not something that they were sort of endorsing. But there is also in the perspective, so the government now seems anyway kind of inclined to go for a free trade deal with the European Union. And also from this perspective, the development of free ports cannot necessarily be that straightforward from a legal standpoint. And I spoke about this with Graham Mather, and he is the chairman of the War Free Zone Convention and a former member of the European Parliament.
The harder the Brexit, the more Britain leaves, the more detached we are from the EU, the more likely it would be possible to operate a free port or free zone system in Britain, but with one exception. That is that even the hard Brexit enthusiasts in the government seem to want to agree a comprehensive free trade agreement with the European Union. And it's not at all certain that if you had such an agreement, Brussels might insist that, for example, the state aid rules are in some way replicated in that agreement. So even some varieties of hard Brexit, we may find Brussels attempting to reintroduce these sort of requirements which make it difficult to establish free ports and free zones.
So again, Brexit not necessarily kind of frees up the hands of the government in terms of defining a future foreign trade policy, most of all when it comes to strike deals with these big economic blocs like the European Union.
And I think that's what we'll see with the majority of business regulation. I mean, there's still will have to adhere to many EU standards and policies in order to strike an agreement.
Okay, well, I would say just a very last point for both of you. So looking forward, what are your expectations now? There are talks unfolding in Brussels. They haven't talked about trade yet because the European Union wants to, first of all, to fix citizens' rights, the issues with the border between Ireland and Northern Ireland. So the situation is that we didn't really make much progress from last June. But looking forward, what are your expectations?
I think we're going to still stand by the estimates we came up with earlier, which is about a 1% reduction in GDP if we Brexit, but get a Norway-style deal. And if that instead goes to a WTO-type deal, which means where we don't really have any kind of comprehensive trade agreement with the European Union, we think about 3% would be the drop in British GDP. But that's coming just from the trade effects. If we start factoring in what might happen if it becomes harder to find people with appropriate skills or if foreign investment, as we've noticed, has gone down, then I think those numbers become a lot bigger. So our estimates are in the range of 2 to 8%. Very hard to say what precisely the number should be because it all depends on what kind of deal. And I think the important factor should be trying to get a quick transition deal so that there's not any kind of immediate disruption.
My predictions on FDI are still quite pessimistic. It's very hard to see any scenario other than a continued decline in FDI in the UK as this plays out. The question is only how much and whether that will pick back up. One of the worrying things is there is the appearance of some chaos in the negotiating strategy. And I know that many business leaders that I've talked to who might have initially had some optimism about some of the upsides of Brexit are now questioning the government's ability and competence to get a good deal. And I think if that continues to be the case, or at least appear to be the case, then confidence will be hit. And I think we would see investors holding off and pulling back a bit.
Well, definitely the government has to get its act together to at least to express some sort of renew some confidence towards the local business, British investment and business environment. Swati, Courtney, thank you very much for being on the show. Thanks, everybody, for listening. You can follow the FDI podcast on our website, fdiintelligence.com/podcast, or on any major podcast platform like Acast and iTunes. Stay tuned.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.